Audio conversation with Jeff Kripal, recorded November 5th, 2011. Jeff Kripal is a professor at Rice University in Texas, where he is also the chair of the Department of Religious Studies. He's authored a series of books, but the two books that I'm going to focus on in this interview, one, his most recent book, is titled Mutants and Mystics, and it is a interesting study of science fiction and comic book lore and how they relate to the mystical. And he does a beautiful and engaging job of investigating just that quandary. And I was delighted by it, mostly just because I like science fiction and comic books. So he really sucked me in. Now, he also wrote another book called Authors of the Impossible, where he looks at four authors. And these authors include Jacques Vallée and Charles Fort. And he looks at how these authors have stepped into the realm of the paranormal and tried to document it, make sense of it, and ultimately how they tried to frame these paranormal events in a very, very big picture way. It's fascinating stuff. I've included a whole bunch of links in the show notes, including Jeff's own podcast series, which is called Impossible Talk, as well as some links to excerpts of the book. I recommend both these books highly. I particularly recommend the Mutants and Mystics book just because it is it deals with comic books so much, and he has a lot of very, very beautiful references and beautiful color plates in the book. Just holding the book in the hand is a very, very lovely experience. I had a thoroughly enjoyable time talking to Jeff, and I hope you get something out of this interview. Please enjoy. Jeff, I want to thank you so much for saying yes to this interview. It really means a lot to me.
Oh, well, it means a lot to me, too. I enjoy these things.
Good, good. Here, just as a way to begin this, I'm holding in my hand a book called Mutants and Mystics, which I am in the act of reading right now. I haven't finished it. It's great. It resonates very strongly with me. And I first heard about you when you did a brief interview with Christopher Knowles on his site. That was for your previous book titled Authors of the Impossible. And let me just say something about Christopher Knowles. When I first heard about Christopher Knowles, he was being interviewed on a podcast, and that's the very first time I got introduced to his line of thinking. And he responded to the interviewer, and the interviewer said, "Oh, we really don't have any mythology these days." And Chris immediately responded that, "No, you know, we are swimming in mythology. We are awash in mythology, and it is showing up right now in the form of..." And as I was listening to that audio, I kind of shouted at my computer, and I said, "It's showing up in the form of the UFO phenomena." But that's not what Christopher Knowles said. His declaration was, "Mythology is showing up in the form of the superhero comics." Now, I think both Chris and I are seeing the same mysterious force playing itself out, and we are both aware of its performance, albeit on different stages. And for the reasons of this interview, I'm just going to attempt to keep it all focused on the UFO lore, because that's something I'm much more familiar with.
Sure, but you know, as the Mutants and Mystics book points out, the superhero mythologies wouldn't exist without the motif of the alien and the UFO, so they're all woven together. But I'm happy to focus on the UFO thing.
Good, and just so you know, I come from that generation where I had stacks of Marvel comics. I'm a huge fan of Jack Kirby, and I am actually working on my own graphic novel right now, albeit slowly, that in a way to attempt to come to terms with some of my own personal experiences.
Right, that's great.
Can you just give, from your point of view, a summation, which might be hard to do, of the content of this book?
So, okay, well, I got to back up a bit, Mike. In 07, I published a book called Esalen, America and the Religion of No Religion, which is a history of the human potential movement, which originated out in California and really flourished in the counterculture. And while I was interviewing folks for that book, I kept encountering stories about various paranormal abilities, UFOs, the whole range, that were simply impossible. But they clearly happened. And so I began to struggle with how to handle these stories in that project. And so the other thing that happened to me there was, as I was finishing the Esalen book, I became obsessed with my Marvel comic collection from my youth. So I found myself pulling it out of the closet and visiting book comic book stores and spending way too much money on old comics. And I didn't know why. I didn't understand this. Was it just a kind of midlife regression? What was going on? And I realized, though, at some point that the basic idea of the human potential movement is that the human being is vastly more magnificent and capacious than we normally imagine, and that we have these abilities and forms of mind in us that are normally suppressed by our culture, and that things like paranormal abilities and mystical experiences are essentially buds, evolving buds of our future supernature. And I realized that that's basically the X-Men. What I was looking at is a model where American culture has produced a series of mythologies on the East Coast and was at the same time living them out as a series of mystical thinkers and movements on the West Coast. And so I became really fascinated by that resonance and set out to write Mutants and Mystics. So the Mutants is a reference to the New York comic industry, and the Mystics is a reference to the California Human Potential Movement. And so that's how I came to write that book. What actually happened, though, is I ended up writing Authors of the Impossible first, because I realized I couldn't really understand what was going on in the science fiction and the comics unless I understood more about the history of psychical and paranormal phenomena. So Authors is the intellectual history, and Mutants and Mystics is how it all plays out in popular culture.
So part of the reason I set up this which I'll just give you a little heads up here before we go into this, the reason I set up this blog and this podcast system is because of my own personal set of experiences, which some UFO researchers are very quick to label as UFO abduction, and that may very well be true, though I don't have any direct experience of that. I do have some things that certainly indicate that, and some of the experiences I've had are extremely strange, though they presently seem to be manifesting themselves in the realm of like very powerful, profound synchronicities that seem to be pointing towards the UFO abduction lore.
Yeah,
I could give you some specific examples, but you know, if once I start talking, it might be hard to shut me up. So,
you've had these experiences, and that's the source of the interest. That's a significant point.
Yes, and it's more in a combination of the source of the interest as well as it sort of goes beyond interest, where it feels like it's like I've been confronted with a mystery, and it's very challenging.
Yeah.
You know, like just to sort of realize that, you know, like perhaps it's sort of lonely, to be quite honest, you know, to realize that, you know, very few people share what I've experienced. So, you know, when I tell these stories, you know, no one can be, you know, can be supportive in a way that maybe I am needing. And, that said, with the advent of the internet, I've connected with a lot of people. And that connection has been really interesting. I don't know how Whitley Strieber did it before the advent of the internet.
Yeah. Well, we should talk about that loneliness, because that, you know, that's the classical structure of the mystical as the secret. And, you know, there are ways to talk about that.
In Authors of the Impossible, which I'm jumping back to the other book, you told about an experience when you were a young boy of seeing a UFO.
Right, and which I don't remember.
Yes, but can you briefly retell that now?
Well, yeah, it's sort of funny, really. I mean, I was sitting with my mother, actually. We were watching American Idol. It was probably 3 or 4 years ago. And we were just munching on popcorn or something. And this really stupid car commercial came on with this really fake flying saucer on it. And Mom just out of the blue said, "Oh, well, do you remember the time we saw a UFO?" And I was like, "No, I have no memory of that." And then she proceeded to tell this fairly elaborate story about us driving in northern Nebraska at night when I was probably five, and seeing a very large rectangular craft in the sky that really scared Mom and Dad because it seemed to be following us. And again, I quizzed her then. You know, I talked to Dad about it. Dad confirmed the story. I asked my brother. Of course, he didn't remember it. He's younger than I am, so he was like 3 or 4. So, again, I have no memory whatsoever of this, not because I was abducted or anything, just because I was 5. But it was clearly some kind of encounter. My first feeling was that it had something to do with Sac Air Force Base, which is just a couple hundred miles east of there. But Mom insisted it was just too big and too square or rectangular to be a military plane. So that's the one UFO story I have, and it's not really even mine. It's my mother's.
Well, that said, you were present, and just yeah. For me, I look at that story through the eyes of like an investigator, and to me that's a very interesting story, and that who knows the impact that had, whether subconsciously or consciously, and just now to see the work you are doing, that to me is very much an ingredient in the content of this bigger book that I'm holding in my hand here, Mutants and Mystics.
Well, that's true. That's absolutely true. And I mean true in the sense that that's a plausible idea. The other origins of the Mutants and Mystics book is what I studied for about a decade in graduate school and early in my career was the goddess Kali, the Hindu goddess Kali. And I was particularly obsessed with her eyes. And if you look at images of Kali's eyes, they're essentially identical to Spider-Man's eyes. And those in turn are essentially the same kind of iconic almanine of the alien. So there's this weird symbolic resonance moving through the comic books of my youth with Spider-Man and this tantric goddess of my early adulthood, and then these last two books really on the mythology of the alien.
And you use the term mystic in the title of the book, and you equate modern comic book authors and science fiction writers to our present day mystic. And can you just give a definition of mystic? That's such an open-ended term in a way.
Well, I prefer the adjective mystical. I mean, I do refer to people who have had these experiences as mystics. But, the mystical is Greek. It means secret. And it has a long history in Western philosophy and religion. And it normally refers to the secret meaning of a text, the secret nature of a human being, or the secret structure of the cosmos. And so the mystical quite literally is the secret essence of things. The way mysticism came to be used in the 19th and 20th century, it referred to particularly dramatic religious experiences in which the person became one or even identical with the divine. So when we refer to a mystical experience, we're not referring to something fuzzy or abstract. We're referring to a type of religious experience in which the human being comes to understand himself or herself to be identical to either God or the cosmos or however they understand the ultimate.
Now you are going through an investigation of sorts. And you're also an academic, but it seems like you're using your intellect as well as your intuition.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I hope so. I mean, I began my young adulthood, I was studying to be a monk in a Benedictine monastery. So what I was really interested in was the contemplative life. And the monks were also scholars. They had a profound intellectual sensibility. So they themselves were uniting what we might call the left and the right sides of the brain's functioning. And I've always tried to, you know, keep those two online in what I write and how I think. And, you know, I've had a few very humble and very episodic mystical states myself. So I think out of those as well. You know, there have been just enough of them to make me open-minded about things I would otherwise probably be closed-minded about.
Oh, that's very interesting, because that's one of the tensions that exist specifically in the UFO research community is, you know, the very, very hard science folks who quite often are looking at government documents, for instance, and they are attempting to make sense of this mystery through purely analytical means, and they end up coming up short, as well as the folks who are going at it at an intuitive level, and they are also coming up short. So it does require a marriage of those two disciplines.
Well, that's the whole point of the Authors of the Impossible book, is that if you approach a paranormal experience with just the tools of science, you're going to get locked into this either-or up-down vote, and that's not very helpful. I think these experiences are actually better approached through what we call the humanities and looking at these as essentially refractions or reflections of some kind of consciousness out there. And so, you know, when I listen to people talk about their paranormal experiences, what I hear are narratives. I hear stories. I hear experiences that are coded and structured around meaning and metaphor and symbol. I don't hear mechanisms and mathematics and causal networks. And so I think the constant desire to prove everything through the scientific method is understandable and certainly worthy on its own terms, but it will never get us to where I think we really ultimately need to go, which is beyond that.
Hey, this book, Mutants and Mystics, I'm just going to just want to give you a great big compliment, is a beautiful book. It is beautifully laid out. It has really elegant illustration plates that mostly are little glimpses from what would be pulp comic books or comic book pages. And I just really need to say thank you. I was an art director in a previous life. I need to say thank you for, you know, going to the effort of making this such a beautiful book. It makes the actual act of reading it much more engaging, and it allows me, and hopefully other people, to take the content more seriously, given the fact that it just has such a stunning layout.
Well, there's a couple things to say there, Mike. One is that, of course, I didn't do any of that. I mean, this is teamwork. This is my sixth book with my editor, David Brandt, at the University of Chicago. And the press was bold enough and kind enough to kind of go all out on this book. They've never done a book like this. And so they invested resources, and my dean in school at Rice invested resources, and so this was very much a team effort. An artist by the name of Michael Brim did all the interior design. Mike's a big fan of Jack Kirby, so it has a very Kirby-esque feel to it. But it's all really Mike's work. And the other thing to say there is again, the theme of the book is that what makes comics so unusual is that they're generating, they're invoking both the left brain with its language and the right brain with its images, and they're doing both at the same time. And so I wanted to produce a book that, you know, could reenact that could fire both sides of us. Fire as in, you know, activate both sides of this, as it were.
There is an interaction in people who claim the direct contact experience with the UFO that is perfectly strange. It is absurd in a lot of ways, and also challenging is the wrong term. It seems like it's challenging in a way that a Zen master would challenge a student.
Right.
And there's something going on that seems more profound than simply the pop culture definition, the very superficial pop culture definition of the UFO lore, which would be just a metal spaceship flying here filled with scientists that are, you know, here to conduct experiments the same way we do. So in essence, we're just anthropomorphizing the occupants to us present day. But it doesn't take much. You just have to immerse yourself a little bit in the literature of the UFO lore and talk to a few people who claim the firsthand experience, and you realize that something much more complicated and much more mysterious is going on. And how do you see that playing out? I mean, you use a term, the imaginal, which is a term I like as a way to try to articulate these grander ideas.
Well, Mike, this was the point I was trying to make earlier. If you approach something like a UFO encounter with a kind of scientism, and you think you're looking at a piece of hardware in the sky, I think you're done before you begin. Because I think a lot of these encounters are essentially koans in the sky. I mean, they're designed to frustrate our categories. They have a trickster quality to them. I mean, this is something that we've noticed, you know, all the way back to, you know, Carl Jung wrote a little book called Flying Saucers in 1958, and he pointed this out already in 1958, that no matter how you approach these encounters, you are frustrated. So they seem to have a quality to them very much like a Zen koan or riddle. And so I couldn't agree more with that. The authors of the Impossible book, you know, there's a whole chapter on Jacques Vallée, and this was essentially Vallée's point as well in 68 with Passport to Magonia, that, gosh, these don't look like hard technology. They look more like folklore or mysticism. And again, that's why I think it's more fruitful to approach these experiences with the tools of the humanities and the study of religion than it is with the scientific method.
I just wrote that down when you said these encounters are koans in the sky. That's the first time I'd ever heard that. That's a very interesting and I guess prescient way to say it, because that seems to be playing out as very real. Having myself to talk to a lot of people who claim this experience. Hey, how do you define the role of synchronicity in all this?
Well, I've written a lot about synchronicity, and again, it's the same point. A synchronistic experience is an event in the physical environment that corresponds usually almost perfectly to a psychic state, a psychological state, and that the event appears to be organized around meaning and metaphor and not cause and effect. So this is a term that Carl Jung coined. And that's essentially what he meant. He meant an event, a real event, that is acting more like a mind or a story than it is a causal network. And I think these things happen all the time. I think the world does behave like a story. It's a kind of living story. And what you see, of course, when you talk to people who have had these UFO encounters, is that they often generate this sort of cloud of synchronicities then. And so I take that as a real thing. But again, something we can't study with science. You need to know how to interpret literature or narratives to understand synchronicities.
Yeah, I'll just add that in my own life, I had a few stories that I could tell, and those stories I could you know, share them around the campfire or around a dinner table, and people would sort of think they were interesting, and I could tell them in a way that were open-ended, and I really never looked any deeper into them. At a certain point, which would have been about 6 years ago, I started looking into them myself, and I started looking in rather aggressively. And at that moment, the act of looking into them, this cloud of synchronicities, I felt like I was awash in synchronicities.
Right.
And that cloud exactly paralleled my own looking into this subject. And this, in a way, when I read, or actually when I heard you talk about it on Whitley Strieber's podcast recently, you told a story about finding a little X in a parking lot. And if you could tell that story, that would be that to me matches what a lot of people who are immersed in this phenomena will, they'll be able to resonate very deeply with that experience.
Well, yeah, this is why I wrote Mutants and Mystics. The synchronicity actually generated or helped generate the book. What happened again is it was the summer of 06, and this was the point at which I was obsessed with the X-Men and why they look so similar to my Human Potential writers. And I remember I was just finishing this book on the Human Potential movement. And I went to, I think it was the second X-Men movie. I don't remember. We could easily look that up. But I was literally in the theater watching this X-Men movie again, just kind of blown away by all the parallels between the mythology and the mysticism I'd been studying. And I was really in one of those sort of states or zone. I was in the zone, as it were. And I walked out of the theater just still obsessing about this. And I walked up to our minivan, and there was something shining in the sun and on the pavement. And I thought it was a cross at first because it looked like a cross. And I picked it up, and it was a perfect little X, little piece of costume jewelry, not worth anything as an object, but priceless actually to me at that moment, because it literally X marked the spot. It really confirmed for me that intuition I had had about the mysticism and the mythology resonating between one another was basically correct. And that was the moment I decided to, you know, spend the next 5 years writing these next two books. And I think that's how synchronicities are made to function, actually. Again, I don't think these are scientific experiments. I think these are signs or symbols that, if we choose to engage them, will continue to engage us and will kind of guide our activity, particularly if someone has an artistic intellectual or scientific streak. I think this is how a lot of things are discovered, actually.
Yes, I feel I could not agree more. You said it beautifully. And on one level, you know, and I say this over and over and over again, the only thing, you know, like, you can't really start a new religion just from a synchronicity, but you can, pay attention.
Yeah.
And your synchronicity matches something. There's an author that I interviewed named Gibbs Williams, and he wrote a book about synchronicity. He's an academic, and he had been a psychiatrist for a number of decades, I think 30 years, and he had been focused on synchronicity the entire time, and he had all his patients keep journals. And then in their journals, they wrote about synchronicities, and they all fit into this pattern from his research, this tidy pattern, where people would be in a place of wanting, they would be in a place of angst, they wouldn't be in a place of I don't want to say existential crisis, that's way too strong, but they would be definitely looking for something, pursuing something. The synchronicity would happen, almost a crescendo would take place in the orchestration of their life, and it would change. They would then be set on a new path, and that matches perfectly with your story that you just shared just there. It's extremely tidy. And it is interesting that the X is, your first thought that it was a cross, which is a very mythic image in its own.
Right. Yeah, no, it wasn't fair. You know, I still, if we turn Skype on here, Mike, I could show you the X. I mean, it's hanging on the wall behind me.
Maybe at the end, I'll do a little screen grab. We can do that.
I even framed it, and it's hanging right next to a graffiti art piece of Mystique on my wall.
And I have, this would be way too long to tell it, but I have a bottle of suntan lotion that I keep in a very sacred place in my house. And the synchronicity involving that is too bizarre for words, but I won't go into that right now. So, this one of the things I want to thank you for doing is immersing yourself in, or immersing the content of this book, or me, the reader, is immersed in what would be considered very lowbrow art. The tawdry comic book. Are you receiving any kind of, I don't want to say backlash, but what is your fellow academicians say about this topic?
Well, I don't know. We'll see. my sense, Mike, is, look, it sounds like you're roughly the same age. We may be a few years apart.
I think I'm a couple years older than you. Just judging by the age you were when you were 5 years old.
I was 62. So
what, you were born in 62?
Yeah.
We're exactly the same age.
Okay, there you go.
And Helen,
Well,
I'm just gonna now, just before we go any farther, anyone who's listened to this thing, that surprised me when you said you were born in 62. I have been finding people born in 1962 at a pattern that is a little bit beyond mere coincidence, in my opinion. And just that you said that, literally the hairs on the back of my neck rose up. And you and I share one more thing in common, and that would be our birth year. So keep
Yeah.
going.
Well, anyway, so when fellow academics found out about this project as I was writing it or as it was being produced, they would often pull me aside at a party or at an event, and they would basically begin to confess to me that, they still read graphic novels, and they had this whole sort of essentially secret identity that they were carrying around. So I, academics are human beings too, and they were also, a lot of them were also born in 1962. So I'm not really concerned about that. I think it'll be warmly received by most people, and I think it will be resisted by some. But that's the nature of any book. That's just what happens when you take a position on anything.
Yeah, okay, good, fair enough. Hey, so the term mystic, which is in the cover of your book, and how do you define that? I guess let me ask this question. How do you define shaman? Because there's sort of a blending between what a mystic might be and what a shaman might be.
Well, listen, there's a lot of overlap. I use the word mystics for a couple reasons. One is, my artists and authors use it all the time. I mean, they use the word to describe their own experiences. It's an academic word. We made it up. Mysticism is something we made up in the 19th and 20th century to talk about all of these unusual experiences that have always been happening in human history. Shamanism is another word we made up to basically put under the same umbrella all of these holy men and women of indigenous cultures who specialize in altering their consciousness and traveling to the other world to aid the community or to guide a soul to the other side or to help the hunt or whatever the task might be. So there's a great deal of overlap between traditional shamanism and what we today call mysticism, but they're two words with different histories, and shamanism tends to name essentially the mysticism of indigenous and tribal cultures, and the word mysticism tends to be used in the West to talk about, essentially world religions.
And it's interesting because there seems to be a hunger in our culture right now for some sort of shamanistic role. I think that we are spiritually, collectively in the West, void of something that we might need deep down. And in that primitive village, in that indigenous community, the shaman, may walk down a path and see butterflies and flowers, and his synchronicities and his mystical experiences would all be based on those things that would be around him. We don't really live in that world anymore. The things that are surrounding us are pop culture, and it seems that these same synchronicities, these same mystical experiences, are welling up inside this realm as a way to fill that need that we have as a society.
Well, I think that's right. Basically, what we're talking about when we talk about synchronicity is essentially a shiny new word for what we would have earlier called magic. Magic are these practices that posit some profound connection between an internal state of mind and physical reality, and that's exactly what a synchronicity is. So. And I think those things continue to happen in the modern world because that's what reality is. It's not this dead chunk of matter. It's this living being that is always communicating to itself, and we're part of that self that it's communicating to. So I think these are just modern ways of talking about very old human experiences.
And I feel like the shamans today, the mystics today are showing up in the form of I'm going to say the UFO contactees, and then Christopher Knowles may say the comic book authors, and in a way, I think we're almost, we're talking about the same, meta phenomena that's making itself known to these divergent folks. How did you come to meet Whitley Strieber, and how did you come to his material?
Well, okay. How I'm trying to remember now. Well, I was writing Mutants and Mystics, and I was vaguely aware of Strieber's books, but I hadn't read them. And I ran across a couple references in Jacques Vallée, actually, the ufologist, that deeply impressed me. And I saw that Strieber and Vallée were in conversation, and so I picked up Communion and read it, and I was deeply moved and impressed by how nuanced it is, and how sophisticated, and how non-dogmatic he was to his own traumatic and mystical experiences. And so I basically asked around and eventually got a contact and just wrote him and introduced myself, and we got to know each other. And then I invited him out to the Esalen Institute a couple times for private symposia, and got to know him and Anne, his wife, quite well. And so we had a lot of very frank and honest conversations about all sorts of things, including his books on the visitors. And so I made Whitley the final case study of Mutants and Mystics, because I felt like I actually probably knew more about his stuff than any of the other authors I looked at in the book. And just, one thing followed another. So I consider Whitley a friend today, and a profound writer about these things.
I've met Whitley also, and feel like I've read all his nonfiction stuff and a goodly chunk of his fiction stuff. I too am very impressed with his tone. He's ever the poet when he writes, in the sense that he's a very, very skilled writer, and he digs really deep. There are a lot of first-person UFO abduction narratives written by people from a deeply passionate place, where they feel like you can just sense they just need to get the story out, and that those stories end up a little more simplistic. Where his narratives, I'm very impressed. They get really deep.
I mean, the title of my chapter on Whitley is called The Third Kind. And what I mean by that is what you just articulated, that, I'm a historian of religion. My job is to take people's religious experiences and to take them seriously, but not literally. My job is not to believe, but neither is it my job to deny what happened to these people. And so what folks like me tend to do is we invoke the category, or the faculty of the imagination, not necessarily as a weaver of fantasy, but as a medium or translator between two different forms of mind. And so when this greater mind communicates to our lesser minds, it can't communicate directly, but it can communicate through the symbols and myths of our religious heritage. And this is what I was so impressed by in Whitley, is he had these incredibly traumatic and transformative experiences, but he refused to take what he saw as what was really there. He was aware that his own literary and imaginative habits were filtering what was happening to him, but he also insisted that something was really there. And it was that both and, that refusal to fall into this either or, that I was so impressed by, and I still am impressed by.
Whitley is a very divisive figure in this little snake pit of the UFO research community, because his experiences don't match exactly what would be a larger pool of experiences that are being recorded by certain researchers. They have sort of dismissed him outright, just because they don't quite match, what they have found the phenomena to be in their own research. And I think that that's, in my opinion, that's a very real mistake, because I've met a lot of people whose experiences don't match that pool. Just to throw the baby out with the bathwater is...
Well, Mike, but listen, this, I mean, again, I'm a historian of religions. What you just described there is exactly how religions behave. You know, they encounter religious experiences that don't match their own dogmas or their own mythologies, and so they condemn them or exclude them. And my job as a historian is not to exclude anything. It's to try to take in what people say happened to them and try to, you know, develop models and ways of thinking that they can include as much of that stuff as possible. So once we start excluding people's experiences as somehow illegitimate or ungenuine simply because they don't fit our own models, I think we're in real trouble. I think we need to be developing better models, not throwing people out.
You need to go to a UFO convention. The metaphor of a religion is very apt when you go to certain conventions. It's very funny, the overall mood sometimes that permeates those things.
Right. Well, actually, yeah, I'm not sure I want to go to a UFO convention. Right. I've seen that before. And, it's very familiar to me. But again, my job isn't to believe it. It's to understand and to move the ball forward, as it were.
What do you see a metamorphosis taking place within, let's just say, the comic book lore where it is moving towards? I mean, I probably could define, you know, what's happened since World War II to present day, but where do you see it in the very near future?
Well, I don't, you know, I'm no predictor. It's a hard thing to talk about because it's really market driven, right? And there are forces here that are well outside the kinds of things we've been talking about. I think writers and artists have grown increasingly sophisticated over the decades. And, you know, when you're looking at an Alan Moore or a Grant Morrison, or an artist like Alex Ross, gosh, you're just on different ground than you were back in the 60s and 70s. And the narratives have gotten much more reflexive, much more self-critical. But sometimes to a fault, I think. I mean, the kind of dark deconstruction of the superhero genre we saw in the 80s and early 90s, that doesn't do much for me. I went to the superhero genre as a kid because I wanted a hero. I didn't want another villain. So I don't know where it's at now. I think it's always interacting with the broader culture. How do you write the Captain America series after 9/11? If you look at the X-Men narratives, they've very effectively embraced all kinds of cultural and moral difference now. When one of the movies when the young man comes out to his parents about his mutation, it's modeled on a coming out scene of a young gay man. So clearly the motifs are there. The mythemes, as I call them, are there, but they're interacting with contemporary culture now. And so I think it's very hard to know where it's going, because we don't really know where the culture's going, other than it's going to get more and more diverse and probably more and more complex.
Yeah, you know, I would say that you said that it was market driven, and I'm just going to disagree. I feel like it's much more passion driven, because these graphic novels and comic books can be made on such a low budget. I mean, the storytelling can be so personal because it's just one person at a desk with a pen when you get right down to it, or a few people, let's say three or four people. So, you know, the stories themselves can be very, very personalized and passionate in that way. And within the last year, I think, Disney purchased all the Marvel line for $1 billion.
I thought it was $4 billion.
$4 billion?
That's what I that's
Oh, you might be right. You might be right. I'm just, anything over, you know, whatever, I'm so broke right now, anything over a few hundred seems like, like impossible for me to wrap my mind around, so.
Right.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Hey, here's my question. Have you read Whitley's graphic novel?
No, I have not.
You know he has one, don't you?
No, I didn't even know he had
You did
one.
not? That's so funny. The guy cranks this stuff out so fast. Yeah, he's got a graphic novel. It's called The Nye Event. Hi there, this is Mike. I am chiming in during the editing process. I just want to say that the name of the graphic novel is The Nye Incidents, and underneath it says inspired by true events. Now, it was not written by Whitley Strieber. It says based on a story by Whitley Strieber and Craig Spector, written by Craig Spector. This graphic novel was published in 2008. It's black and white. It's pretty interesting. And I will also add that Mac Tonies was a big fan of this graphic novel. Just wanted to clear that up. Back to the interview. It's based on a series of human mutilations that supposedly took place in Nye, New York, in I believe the late 80s, early 90s, and it's a fictionalized account of those reports and the detective that looks into them.
I'll look it up. No, I didn't know that.
Oh yeah. It's and it just he just sold the rights to it and as a movie. So and this is actually another thing that I think of as far as just straight technology. The advent of the Marvel comic and the DC comic, mega motion picture is very much arrived at a time when computer-generated special effects could capture the themes that could only have been portrayed through illustration in comic book panels, 30 years earlier, and now they're playing out on this big screen in a way that has captured our society in a way that I'm just amazed at how popular the comic book
Well,
genre is in the motion pictures.
yeah, this is what I mean by when I referenced said it was market driven because, when we were kids, these comic books you could buy them for 20 cents or a quarter, and the people who were making them were not making much money. It was really a pretty low budget industry, and they, if you remember, they did try to make some movies when we were, in our 20s or so, and they just were horrible because they were so cheesy. They couldn't do the superpowers. And so the CGI allows Hollywood to do the superpowers. But what that means is the genre is now carried not by the physical comics as much as by the Hollywood blockbusters. And that's a very elite market-driven group of people.
Yes, and if you look into how many movies are based on graphic novels, what has happened in the last less than a decade, it's shocking how many movies first start out as graphic novels.
Right.
Yeah, this is going great. I feel like I've gone through most of my questions here. Let me just. So, as you've looked into this, and this is, let's just go instead of just the recent works, just in the entirety of your works. Oh, have you had any owl experiences, or how is the figure of the owl played out in these lores?
Well, the owl is the patron of my university.
Ah, there we go. So.
But I haven't had any owl experiences. I had a very funny fox experience. I can tell you my fox story,
Oh,
but not,
please do. I love this kind of stuff.
yeah, it's actually very humorous. So it takes a bit of back, like all synchronicities, it takes a bit of backstory to make it work. So this was 2.5 years ago. I was in Big Sur at Esalen, giving a symposium there, and I was going to fly to Philadelphia to actually give a series of lectures to a Quaker group on retreat on this material, actually. And what you have to know is I was invited to the Quaker group because of my Esalen book. So there was a direct link between Esalen and the Quakers in my mind on this lecture circuit I was on. Okay, so I get up in Big Sur that morning. I get into my rental car and I drive down Highway 1, heading north to San Francisco. And about 5 miles, 10 miles into my trip, this beautiful brown fox comes out of the mountain forest and stands by the side of the road. And just watches me drive by, like she or he, I don't know what it was, looking at me. And I was like, wow, that is so cool. I've never seen a fox in the wild. And there's one just kind of watching me drive by. I wasn't driving fast because Highway 1's this loopy, loopy
thing.
Sure,
I've been on it, yeah.
So you can really see a fox there standing. So I didn't think much. I thought it was odd, but I didn't think much of it. So I drove up to San Francisco, got in a plane, had a bunch of delays, flew clear across the country. I didn't land in Philadelphia till about 12:30 in the morning. And my Quaker host picked me up in a car and drove me to my hotel. And about 5-10 miles into this drive, that same damn fox came out of these trees and watched us drive by again. And I was just I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that happened. And I didn't understand it. I just knew it was a synchronicity, right? I couldn't decode it yet. And I got back to the hotel and was taking a shower. And it hit me just really all of a sudden. I was like, oh my God. I had been reading, to prepare for these lectures for the Quakers, I'd been reading the journals of George Fox. And so there was this really funny sort of lowest form of humor, a pun, kind of acting out in the real world there. And I just took it as a very playful kind of confirmation of what I was doing. Because at that point, I was very tired. I'd been traveling for 3 weeks. And it was just this lovely little playful sign.
Oh, I love those kind of stories. I love that kind of thing. This has struck me that I was driving quite near Esalen on Route 1, driving slow, and a tarantula, I remember very clearly, a tarantula was crossing the road, and whatever that means. So,
I didn't know there were tarantulas there.
Yeah, I didn't either. It was big. You know, I literally had to like swerve the car so I didn't squash it on the highway there. But and the reason I asked the owl question is because for reasons unknown to me, I have been I've seen a lot of owls in the last since that looking into this experience, this since the synchronicity that involved the bottle of sunblock. I have been plagued with owl sightings in a way that I've actually talked to owl biologists near where I live. I live quite close to Yellowstone National Park, so I do live in a place with a lot of owls. But and I've explained what I've seen, and they look at me like, no, that shouldn't happen. That doesn't make any sense.
Well, these of course function in the abduction literature too, as sort of screen memories. So.
Oh, and I'm very familiar with that. And strangely enough, it was Whitley Strieber who commented on a blog post of mine where I had been talking about seeing owls. He just has a way of dropping these bombs, and you've probably you know where he'll just kind of say these things that are like, whoa, right. Like, wow, that was, you know, where'd that come from? And he said, you know, the owls are used by the visitors because their eyes are so skilled at seeing in the dark, and so what is happening, and I can't remember exactly how he phrased it, what is happening is that the owls are using their eyes like a little video camera, and in essence the visitors are watching through the eyes, and the implication is they're watching me, you know, having seen so many owls. I don't know quite if that's true or not. That is a delightful, you know, way to look at it, though.
So, right. That's what I love about this stuff is the ideas are so bold. I mean, they may be totally wrong, but they're so refreshingly bold, and I so appreciate that.
And this is where I go back to the writings of Christopher Knowles and just how excited he gets about, let's say, the work of Jack Kirby, where, for instance, in The Eternals, the gods, which are actually aliens, or the aliens, which are actually gods, which are now interacting with people on Earth. And that was, you know, profoundly bold. And it came, you know, from what amounts to this, you know, nerdy, introverted guy at the height of you know, the waning years of the psychedelic 60s, you know?
Right. Well, and Chris, of course, has this notion of synchromysticism too, which is essentially about synchronicities and precognitive events in comics that sort of forecast or predict things that happen in the real world. I invited Chris out to Esalen a couple times, and he gave two different Kirby presentations that were just, you know, mind blowing.
I would love to see those. I remember when he went out there, he was writing about it, and I didn't realize that was one of the questions I wanted to ask. Is that, you know, did you meet him at those events? Because I know he was there on occasion.
Oh, sure, I invited him.
Oh,
that's how we met. And You know, I was reading Our Gods Wear Spandex, and, you know, I begin Mutants and Mystics with Our Gods Wear Spandex because that's really where the book should begin, as a kind of homage to Chris. I mean, he really did map that thesis out in, I think, the most effective and clear way.
And that, you know, this is where I get back to where Chris and I don't want to say we spar, but I feel like we both have different, you know, areas of expertise and in how close they match in trying to define this, you know, meta phenomena.
Well, you know, again, my Mutants and Mystics book, the second chapter is called Alienation, and it's on the motif of the alien. But it points out that the superhero genre begins with a crashed alien, basically with a crashed UFO, right? I mean, this is the Superman story. Superman is a crashed alien. And so that UFO alien trope runs throughout really the entire history of comic books. And you see it today in movies like, you know, the last Spider-Man movie where, you know, Venom is the suit, the black suit, is in fact an alien symbiote. And so there, you know, there the alien motif appears again as fantasy, obviously. But my point is that Chris's work on superhero mythologies and your work on UFOs as our contemporary mythology are by no means exclusive projects. They meet in so many ways. And of course, Kirby himself was obsessed with the ancient astronaut theory. So there you go again, you know, as you pointed out.
Yeah, the collision of these two ideas. Going through my notes, you're a great person to interview. This has been awesome.
Thanks. I do a lot of this, Mike. It's fun.
And have you been doing a lot? Because I've been looking up online and trying to find some of your interviews to listen to, and I should make an effort to post some of the ones.
You know, if you could mention, the other thing I'd appreciate us talking about briefly is the author's book is optioned by a filmmaker.
And that's actually what I wanted to get to. Oh, keep going.
And of course, we have a podcast up there called Impossible Talk, in which I interview all sorts of people, and those are all available. That's a podcast series. And I'm doing a lot of interviews, online interviews, on the Mutants and Mystics book, which those will appear all this month, actually. There's the latest one is at Patheos. I don't know if you know about Patheos, Patheos. It's a really smart website on how to talk about religion smartly. And they do a book club, and they're doing Mutants and Mystics right now.
Good. Hey, this is actually one of the questions I wanted to ask, and I'm glad you brought it up. The documentary that you're working on, very similar to the book, in the sense that the book is beautifully laid out. It's a delight to hold in my hand, just because of the attention to the art direction. I have on my website, I've posted a short clip from your documentary that you're working on. It's a work in progress. Some of the sequences are actually just storyboard frames. But what's the status of the documentary that you're working on?
Well, there's actually two film projects. The one you were referring to there is the Authors of the Impossible documentary. And that's based on this previous book where we look at these four wonderful authors, Frederick Myers, Charles Fort, Jacques Vallée, and Bertrand Muist on the paranormal. The one we're working on most actively now, before the author's film, is on the Esalen book, and it's called Supernature, Esalen and the Human Potential. And it's very much on this same set of ideas, but it's trying to ground them in recent American history and in a particular idea called the filter thesis, which is essentially the idea that mind or consciousness is not produced in toto by the brain, but is in fact filtered through or mediated or reduced by the brain. And so when people report these psychical, telepathic, precognitive experiences, those in fact fit in very well to what one would expect if mind is not produced by a brain but filtered through it. So that's what we're working most actively on now, and both of those films can be the trailers can be easily accessed on Scott's website, which is just Scott Hulan Jones, H-U-L-A-N. So ScottHulanJones.com.
And the documentary Authors of the Impossible looks like it seems to cross over into the mutants and mystic territory, because for instance, some of the references, yeah, the fellow who
Doug Mensch,
yes, sort of begins the whole documentary the way it's shown in that little clip.
Right, Doug is a very prominent comic book writer, and we begin the clip with Doug's precognitive experience of writing a Planet of the Apes story, and then having that story play out in his own home, actually a few seconds later. Yeah, see, every book I write, Mike, leads to the next book. So the Esalen book led to the Authors of the Impossible book, which in turn led to the Mutants and Mystics book. So they're all, in my own head, they're all one book. It's just sort of churning out chapter after chapter. And so when we sit down to make these two films, there's all kinds of overlap between them, because we're really talking about similar ideas in different contexts.
Have you seen a black and white movie from the 60s titled Incubus?
No.
Uh-huh. Oh my word. Okay, this is you know, right up your alley. It's a it was directed by Joseph Stefano, who brought us he was the executive producer, I believe, and did a lot of the script writing for the first season of The Outer Limits in the very early 60s. So you know, paranormal cult and UFO type stories, and it is filmed on location at in Big Sur. So, you know, has the Esalen tie-in, and it's a sort of a ancient myth parable starring a very young William Shatner, pre-Star Trek, and he and the entire story is done in Esperanto. So they're all speaking this non-language.
Huh.
Yeah, it's great. It's worth renting. You can get it on Netflix. You would just be swallowed up in it. It's great.
That's great. Yeah. No, I don't know that. I'll look it up though.
Yeah, I'll. I just thought, you know, given your study of Esalen and how that narrative is just you know, so wildly immersed in mythic imagery, is just amazing. Yeah. Just an amazing story. Oh, and one thing I also want to say is that I'm going to give you a compliment. I'm sort of the generation where I do not like modern documentaries, especially the cable TV version of the documentary that seems to be produced, you know, for people, you know, holding the clicker in their hand, you know, getting ready to change the channel. I was very impressed by the tone and the pacing, even in that short 7-minute clip of that documentary, Authors of the Impossible. So once again, I have to thank you for treating me, both the viewer and the reader, like an adult in this.
Right. And again, you know, that's the teamwork again. That's Scott. Scott's the filmmaker, and he has this really artistic sense of film and the viewer. And we're not, these two films, you know, the way the paranormal is usually treated in media is in a kind of what I call the cheese factor. You know, it's sort of low budget, either or kind of thinking. And that's what we're not doing. We're shooting for this kind of both and artistic sophistication, and really, you know, not talking down to people, really, really talking to them directly. Because again, I think most people are much more sophisticated about these things than we get, say, on the History Channel. So that's what we're doing. We're trying to offer the creme de la creme of filmic approaches to the paranormal.
I am literally wiping tears from my eyes, the fact that you said that, because that means so much to me. Because I just think that I just praise you to the stars for taking the role of the documentary seriously in that realm. You know, whether it's you or the filmmaker, obviously it's a team effort, so you definitely have an influence.
Yeah, Scott and I are close friends and we work together, so it's really teamwork, and And I appreciate that, Mike.
You, at the end of the Authors of the Impossible book, you wrote about Fatima, and you were raised a Catholic, and the Fatima lore is something that is interwoven in the UFO lore, because of its it doesn't, when you look closely at the details, it does not read like a Catholic miracle. It reads much more like a UFO experience.
Right. This was news to me, actually. I grew up very Catholic, and again, remember, I started out wanting to be a monk and studying at a seminary. So to call me Catholic would have been a gross understatement. And I grew up praying the rosary and being very devoted to Mary and knowing quite a bit, actually, about the various Marian apparitions that have occurred the last couple centuries. And when I was writing the Authors of the Impossible book, I kept running into all these references to Fatima in these books, and I was always really fascinated by that. So I read into the literature, and sure enough, the historical documentation around Fatima is quite ambiguous, and you can certainly read it in Catholic Marian terms, but you can also read it in UFOlogical terms. And I think the fairest reading is to read it in both terms at the same time. And again, that's really the point of the book in that last little section, is to sort of make the strange even stranger.
Are you familiar with an author named Alexandra Bruce? Sometimes she goes by the name of Sheikah Bruce.
I am disappointing you on so many
Ah,
levels,
this
Mike.
is. Don't worry, don't worry. Here, I'll just this. You'll find this interesting. She grew up in Brazil, and she translated much of the original documentation that was then used by I believe his name is Joaquin Fernandez for his trilogy of books.
Yeah, now the trilogy I read that trilogy.
Well, she did. She did some of the translation of the original documents, because the original documents were written in Portuguese. They
Yeah.
then got handed over to the Vatican. They were rewritten in Latin, and then everything since that point, people have been referencing the Latin documents. But when you go back to the original documents, much more of the paranormal details begin to emerge. So she told of an experience in 2005. She was at her computer. She was literally turning her computer off because she had finalized the last bit of translation of the text. And then suddenly she sort of says the room got foggy, and she had a pass, excuse me, like a life review, like her life, like a life passing before her eyes. But it wasn't her life. It was the life of Sister Lucia Martio,
Oh, boy.
Marto, who had died
Yeah.
at the age of 97. So she was presented with this fantastic vision of this life review in sort of multi-dimensional layers. One of the things she said was that Sister Marto was the and she was the last remaining eyewitness of the three children
Right.
who died at the age of 97 of the miracle of Fatima. And she said that there was a level of vanity because the guilt that the nun felt about her celebrity status, how she was wrestling with that vanity, which I thought was very interesting. Now, let me also add that Alexandra Bruce, to make things even more complicated and to tie up, even more little webs of weirdness, has had a lifetime of UFO sightings. And sometimes they are very profound UFO sightings, very, very close-up UFO sightings.
I would please send me the references to where she writes about those things. I
Sure.
would love to read that. Thank
I that when I read your little thing on Fatima, I was like, oh my gosh, he has to talk to
you.
Sheikah. I very much will get you that information. I want to go back to the very first question I asked you, the question I asked about the when your mother told you about seeing a UFO with you, your father, and your brother all in the car together. And that story is told in the Authors of the Impossible book, and I believe that the chapter is called Two Childhood Encounters.
Right, that's the epilogue, actually.
Yes. So the epilogue where it has your story,
Right.
which you don't remember, and then it jumps right into the Fatima story.
Right.
I've sat across from UFO abduction researchers, some of whose names you would recognize, and told my story, and they listen, and they do this thing where they sort of jump to conclusion, which I'm not super comfortable with, and they just say, "Oh, well, by the mere fact that you've told me this story, I'm going to assume you're a UFO abductee," and that's happened to me more than once, and it's an uncomfortable feeling, but it's coming from their point of view, and I sort of realize that, if you're a UFO abduction researcher, you see, through those glasses, and suddenly everything looks like a UFO abduction.
Right.
For purposes of this, for the question I'm about to ask, I am going to put those same glasses on. If I was a UFO abduction researcher and I heard the story of you, your brother, your mother, your father, so in essence a family in a car seeing a UFO, and I'm assuming it was a lonely road in Nebraska.
Yeah, northern Nebraska is very lonely.
Okay, that's so fair enough. I would have to say, with those glasses on, this sounds suspiciously like a UFO abduction. And the mere fact that you do not remember it, obviously you were five, that's very young, but the fact that you don't remember it, that would then, I could put that into the checklist of, probable UFO abductions. Have you ever asked your parents about anything? Have you asked a missing time or anything like that?
Well, I queried them quite a bit on that event, and they essentially had the same story, but there wasn't any missing time that came out. In terms of the question that you're really asking, what you if the only tool you have is a hammer, then everything looks like a nail, right? And
Exactly, yeah.
if these UFO researchers you're referring to, I would be my answer to this is actually, I hope, fairly nuanced. I would not deny that there are elements of my life experience that look or resonate with the UFO abduction materials, but I'm very uncomfortable taking our modern mythology, which is the UFO, and projecting it into everything, as if we somehow know now that, oh, these are really UFOs, and what really happened to you when you were a kid was a UFO abduction. What really happened at Fatima was a UFO. What really happened to the prophet Ezekiel was a UFO, et cetera, et cetera. I do think there are resonances between all of those events, and that a sophisticated reader can see those. But I'm always suspicious when any reader takes his or her own present mythical framework and reads it back into everything. That makes me nervous. I'm more comfortable using the traditional religious narratives to read the UFO encounters and to use the modern UFO encounters to reread the traditional religious encounters. You see what I'm doing?
Oh yes, very much so.
I'm essentially undermining the absoluteness of both interpretations, but I'm affirming that yes, there are these similarities there. I don't want to deny those. I just want us to be more sophisticated about how we handle these things. And that's why when we were talking about the Fatima ufology stuff, I basically said, well, what I really do in the epilogue is suggest that we need to read those events with both frameworks in mind. And again, that's kind of what I'm trying to do in all of this. And I hope that makes sense. It's certainly not an either-or approach. Again, it's a both-and. But that's my approach.
And that's the very reason that I am so completely smitten with the book Mutants and Mystics, is because it plays with that approach in such a delightful, on one level delightful, just because it's dealing with science fiction and comic book stuff that I deeply adore, and then it goes very, very deep in what the potential meaning that might be revealing itself, from what would be these pop culture, materials.
Right. Well, I appreciate that. You're the perfect reader. You're the person that I dreamed of reaching with that book.
Well, you reached me, so we got that good. So. Good. Kate, I just want to thank you so much for this. This has been delightful. I was actually kind of nervous getting ready for this interview. I was extremely excited. I've been reading the book. I'm not quite done with it. I stayed up last night reading, and
well, there'll be a test, Mike.
Well, please do, and I'll test you on some of my stuff too. So, yeah, that's right. You are a professor. So,
I'm just teasing.
Okay. I'll let you get back to your life.
Sure. Okay, Mike. Take care.
Bye now. Thanks so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye. Wow, that was great. I'm very, very impressed with this guy's outlook. Partially that just comes from my own, obsession with both comic books and the UFO lore. Now, hey, I want to read one little bit here from his book, and this is from the book Mutants and Mystics. It's on page 22, and it is a quote. It includes a quote from Grant Morrison, and Grant Morrison wrote The Invisibles as a way to try to define, I don't know how to say it, his own spiritual outlook or whatever. So here's how it's written in the text. As a fantastic practice, Morrison's approach to religion is at once radically critical and deeply sensitive. Put most simply, organized religion for Morrison is alienating, often intolerant and violent power structures built around a mistaken reading of what was originally a real paranormal experience, like Jesus's, like Buddha's, like his own. And here's the quote from Grant himself. And people just confuse it. They think they've heard the voice of God, or they think they've heard the voice of angels, or the voice of aliens, or the voice of devils. Or, if they grew up particularly fearful and the experience frightens them, they think they've heard the voice of Buddha or Allah. But they haven't. They've just heard their own next room up talking down to them. It's just the next rung up the ladder. And that little quote kind of gives you the flavor of the book. I mean, this, I'm not kidding. This guy digs pretty deep. All that said, I was a little nervous going into this interview. You can kind of hear it in my voice, I think. I was listening to myself talk as I was going through the editing process, and I could certainly hear it. One of the things that surprised me was when Jeff said that he was born in 1962. For folks who have read my blog, there is a kind of odd little thing that I take note of. It may mean nothing at all. It may be just the curious overworkings of my increasingly paranoid mindset. I have run into a lot of people born in 1962, and the thread that ties these people together is a UFO event in their youth, and presently they are being very public in their own research, whether that be through writing books, creating documentaries, doing podcasts, starting a blog, and sometimes all of those all combined into one. I also want to point out that Jeff has a website with podcasts called Impossible Talk, and this is in combination with the crew that is working on the documentary with him. The title of the website is Impossible Talk. He has a handful of recorded interviews. They're fascinating. He's very soft-spoken and quite a skilled speaker, so they make for very engaging listening. I recommend them highly. Just feel free to Google Impossible Talk Jeff Kripal, and I will also include that in the show notes. All that said, I am very, very eager to finish reading this book that I recommend very highly. Its beauty alone makes it worth, holding in your hands and having on your shelf. If you've made it this far, thank you so much. Bye now.
Look, Bruce! It's the bat signal!
Yes, are you ready, Robin?
Yes, Batman! Batman slash start the nuclear power for the Batmobile?
Right again, Robin.
Okay, Batman.
And any teenager with a garage and an electric guitar would know that that was Link, Ray, and the Raymen. And that was the Batman theme. If anyone's made it this far, thank you so much for hanging out. Bye now.